Okay, for our first discussion based on the ideas of the audience, there's actually a couple of them here that go together that a lot of people are interested in, so we'll sort of lead off with those and let everybody else jump in and ask questions and give comments. But basically, the idea is, how do you get from SBND concentrations or concentrations of other passive samplers to the time-weighted average concentrations using PRCs and the latest models, such as the Imperial Uptake model that's in the SPMD book, and then ideas as far as what types of PRCs work well and suggestions as far as what we should use. So we'll open it up to the floor, and we'll be bringing mics around, and any and everybody who's experienced, please chime in.
The first step is to get the book. No, that's just a commercial. The second step would be talk to David Alvarez and Kate Boyd. And David's got his calculator that has all of this, the latest models, Case's great, latest great models, and they're in the book as well. And as far as PRCs, that's the subject that a lot of people should have some input on. In fact, I had a very good idea. Case has his ideas, so.
One thing, just as Huck mentioned, there is a revised Excel calculator that we've put together that uses the latest models and the idea of being able to use multiple PRCs, as Case showed in his presentation yesterday. It will be posted on our center's website soon. We just got to, put together a simple directions sheet, but it's pretty self-explanatory. At this point, if somebody is interested, if you give me an email, we can email it out. But once we get the website up and running, we'll continually just use it as the place to find the latest revisions and any ideas that we have. And speaking of the website, just to get off on a tangent here, after 3 years of not having it updated, Randall Clark from our center went through the enormous effort of updating the SPMD bibliography, and it is current as of about a month or two ago, and that's now online. So if you're looking for the latest research with regard at least to SPMDs, you can go on there, and there's hundreds of citations. So
there is one other comment that I have that Pekka brought up, and in thinking, I certainly agree this is an issue, and that we're going to be using this full-based regression model to use multiple PRCs, and the one thing we have to consider is that some people will not be, if we pick, say, C13 labeled PCB congeners, we have to worry about what our analytical procedures are using, or people doing the GCMS or whatever. And we have to worry about the cost, although apparently they're not too high. But every time you add more chemicals, and we've got PAHs that we butylated PAHs that we normally use, and now we've been using native PCB congeners, but I certainly agree with Pekka that we need to get labeled material as long as we're careful about the selection. But if you're using ECB, then you're not going to be doing the PAHs. Question of how much you're willing to spend. It's kind of like comparing, a Chevrolet to a Lexus. If you want to go the full 9 yards, then you put as many PRCs as we can think of, and they don't have to be limited to PCBs or PAHs. As many as we can possibly think of in the range of the log octanol value within the range of probably 4.5 to 6. But of course, as Kate pointed out yesterday, that range shifts depending on the environmental exposure factors, flow, things like that. So, anybody else?
I think it's difficult to use too many PRCs. It is using too many PRCs is never a problem. Using too little can be a real problem when you have only one and it doesn't dissipate, then you are in big trouble. If there's only one and it dissipates completely, you are in big trouble. And if it dissipates between 10 and 90%, you don't know about uncertainties. So. I would guess that the minimum amount of PRC, minimum number of PRCs to be used is maybe 3 or so, but then you are really on the edge of being able to come up with a reasonably accurate sampling rate. Using PRCs with a hydrophobicity interval difference of 0.2 log units would be great, but then indeed you need a large number of these compounds. However, the cost of that is very small, I think. I mean, you buy these compounds in milligram quantities, but you need maybe several tens of nanograms per sample. So I don't think that the cost will be excessive.
Yeah, I work for a public-owned water and electric utility, and we're looking at working with our USGS friends in Portland and starting to introduce this technology in our water quality evaluations of our source. And my question is, do you need to use PRCs if you have a known flow rate, like if we're putting these into our raw water intake, given that we're introducing some chemicals like PCBs, PAHs, even though they're bleeding off at very small amounts, it's more of a public perception. And also, if we put these in our finished water, we don't want to be bleeding off stuff into the finished water. I guess a follow-up question is, if we do put these in our finished water, does chlorine, would chlorine have an impact on the either the SPMDs or the POSAs?
Since we're only using for the PRCs, PAHs, deuterated PAHs, we use a lot more in terms of quantity, microgram quantities, right? Bulk. And for the PCBs, they're probably most of the chlorinated things that we might come up with. You're talking about if you're doing GCMS or if you're doing ECD, then you're only talking about 20 to 30 nanograms, maybe 10, possibly in some cases. So I think first that you must establish what your conditions are in your facility. And if you're absolutely certain that things are not going to change in terms of temperature, flow, that sort of thing, then maybe you can get away with just doing the calibration one time. But I think it has to be done. We can't really accurately extrapolate flow to sampling rate. If you look at Case's chapter in the book, looking at all the data sets, external flow around the SPMD is not really a very good indicator of what the sampling rate is going to be. What causes the sampling rate to change is right at the boundary layer. It's only at the most a millimeter, maybe, in the ocean, sea, or. But otherwise, you're talking about hundreds of still micrometers. So there's no way to estimate that effective resistance to mass transfer, or that boundary layer effect, which is controlling the uptake rate, without using PRCs at least once. We just have no other parameters to extrapolate from. Do you agree with that, Kate?
I think a lot of it is that you're going to have to deal with is more of a perception versus reality type issue. In reality, what's bled out, nobody will ever find it. It's such a low level. But as soon as somebody hears, and even, you know, somebody on the city council or something hears that there's a chemical that we're bleeding out, it's going to be difficult to make them understand. So it's going to be a perception issue. But I agree with them. I think you're going to need something. Otherwise, your data might be more qualitative.
There's a comment from Craig in the back.
We had three drinking water treatment plants in our watershed that were really the main concern that people had was the drinking water issues. And we had designed but didn't get any funding from EPA for doing a project. Basically, in using a bathtub, we kind of designed a simple, low-cost process for wasting a part of their raw water and part of their finished water. Just, you know, put a tap in line, and, you know, they know how much flow they take in each day and how much they waste from their intake, and then you can do calculation based on that to determine what concentrations they're using. We suspected that most of the PCBs that were in the raw water were probably taken out by the TDS, removal from sand filtration or traditional water treatment plants, but we just wanted to prove whatever level was detectable, you know, at our raw water intake was removed, but we didn't get any funding to do that. But the finished water is the same type of process. You just have a bathtub or some type of a pooling device to have your SPMDs in there and the water flow through the process and then flush it to your drain. We did have, and I know this has been done in other places too, in a wastewater treatment plant, a sample, an SPMD sample on three different occasions in their chlorination tank. And chlorine affects a couple of things. We're not sure about the ratios of any of the congeners or what is actually affecting chemically at the interface to the SPMD, but we did see a little different pattern than we saw in the rest of the tributaries in our watershed, and it may be just because there's an industrial source that's traditional through some of the old, 75-year-old drain lines that come into this plant. But we didn't see much biofouling in the chlorine contact tank, which you'd expect, and this one was about 3 meters deep. So it also didn't get as much sunlight down there, so not as much photodegradation. We saw a lot less PRC loss from photodegradation when we were using PAH PRCs in there.
And the idea that Craig was just mentioning about having a separate tank, that's almost exactly what the city of Santa Cruz is doing for their wastewater on that poster that's out. And that seemed to work real well because they could have controlled conditions and they're not impacting the main water. So if you're talking about drinking water, you know, if, as long as you can pipe a little bit of it off at a known rate and known volume, you know, you could, you know, to use that for your exposures and not be introducing anything into the main pipe that's going out to everybody's homes.
Well, I have a related issue. My frustration is that I like to do toxicity tests on the extracts of passive samplers, and if you introduce most of the PRCs that I've seen available, they're potentially toxic. So is there some way that somebody can come up with something, a PRC that's either inert or potentially not toxic for the assay that you're going to be looking at, that would be really beneficial, at least to a lot of studies that I do?
I'm going to jump in here. I have a comment that came in online, and then we'll continue to move the mics down. Actually, Bo Pneep, that was referenced yesterday, is simply making a remark. He says, in the case of a wastewater treatment plant, there is power available, and the passive sampling can easily be made active to make any sampling rate constant by rotating pump or whatever other method. I'm just reading it on his behalf.
Well, I guess the simple answer to, back to what Steve just brought up, the easy thing to do in what we do is, it's rare that we ever have just one SPMD out. If for no other reason, you're afraid that it's a one-shot deal, and that one may be the one that gets damaged by sand or whatever else coming through the stream. So if you had one that had the PRCs for your chemical analysis, and then had one for your toxicity, then you're okay. We have them all the time in canisters. They're literally a few millimeters apart, and you don't see, the exchange, because with any water movement, the PRCs are going to float away and not necessarily into the next SPMD. So, but obviously, if you only have one, you can't spike toxic chemicals in there, then expect to, do a bioassay.
Dave, there's another option. Steve is using Microtox, or if you want to use something else that's going to look at the P450 system, specifically, say 1A, where you're looking at in a cellular in vitro way. What you can do also is, one, adjust the volume of the PRC in there, and also make sure it's something that is not going to be picked up by the AHR. And there are the majority of PCBs, in fact, won't be. The large, heavier weight ones will, the ortho substituted ones won't even pick up. That doesn't mean that they wouldn't affect microtox. They could, but they could interact in some way. But there's enough. There might be at least a good idea, a starting point, to look at which ones could be candidates.
I think that it is possible to use PRCs in even in freshwater sampling, but stable conditions, maybe you don't need it after some time. But the ethical question to use it in freshwater is maybe an issue, but I think we still allow chlorination of drinking water. I mean, then if you add some nanograms of another chemical, it doesn't matter. I think the big issue that you're missing here is introducing the PRCs also includes a cost of analysis. And the more compounds you have to analyze for, the more expensive will the analysis be. And that cost is much higher than the spiking on the chemical itself. Especially if you have a PRC that requires a different analytical method than your target compound. So that you have to be very careful for. So introducing one big series of chemicals needing a different cleanup, different analysis, will be very costly. And reducing to fewer compounds, but with a different behavior, different cleanup rates, will make it more versatile.
Well, I agree with what Becca says, but I also agree with what Kay says. So what does that make me? I'm not sure. But, if ideally it would be best. I mean, you get what you pay for, and that's basically what it's going to boil down to. If you want the Chevrolet versus the Lexus or whatever it is, and then you're very selective about what you use for PRCs, and then you only use a few, perhaps. But it's mainly the cost is whether you're going to be doing PAHs and PCBs and that sort of thing. Isn't that correct, Becca? So using, if you're doing ECDs, then you're not going to be doing PAHs. You have to do FID or GCMS, whatever. So that is an issue. One last first comment by the gentleman up there about formation and Craig's comment about chlorination effects on PCBs, I really don't know, but I do know that Alkay in Sweden has used SPMDs in a PVC plant in which it was maybe the medium that he was doing this exposure in was about 10% HCl, and he got very nice results.
It was actually concentrate HCl, and it had a 40 degrees temperature. And the spider disappeared. It was the salt, the stainless steel.
And again, before we go on with the comments, a reminder to those of you online, use the question mark button to submit comments or interact, and I will read on your behalf.
Just to speak to the point about extra cost of analysis when you add a PRC, it, maybe I'm missing something, but shouldn't you choose your PRC to be as similar to your analytes as possible in the case of if you want it to behave like your analytes and you want to be able to get a sampling rate that's similar, or is there another criteria that I'm missing?
Depends what kind of sample you're using, I think. If you're using nonpolar samplers, then log-KLW is the predictor of sampling rates, and then you would be okay to use chlorinated PRCs when you're doing pH analysis. In practice, I think often you, when you do your pH research, that you also, it's natural to also use PRC.
I have a comment that came in online, and then we'll carry on in the room. Again, from the Netherlands, Folk states that regarding cost of analysis, the golden rule is that good analysis or good analysis is basically expensive, and he has in parentheses used PRCs. Wrong or bad analyses are usually more expensive than that.
I'd like to.
Yeah, as being a beginner at this field, I would like to know, I'm planning to start with POSIS deployment in the river, in the creek, actually. I just want to know if anybody has done any spiking. We call it, actually, chemists, we call it surrogate, the compound that we add at the beginning of your study and carrying through the whole process. So if anybody has done that already, added compound prior to deployment and then look at the recoveries at the end of the experiment.
Just a second.
In response to your question, we also refer to those as surrogate samples and or procedural spikes for the processing and analysis of the samplers. And these are indeed added at the point where we start processing deployed samples. We also add them to blanks that have never been deployed, as well as trip blanks. And these typically are the C13 PCB congener surrogates, which we measure losses for processing. And these don't serve the same function as a PRC, but the ones that are deployed, they would function as a PRC, but they are also then a procedural standard for processing losses. It's a fairly common practice, but the more things that you introduce as a chemist, the more work you have to do to get the numbers, but the more data that you can collect, the better you are. So we have to work within the framework of what do we want to limit, how far we investigate. Are we willing to spend large numbers of dollars or euros or whatever our currency is, and do we want to spend a lot of time to get relevant quality numbers, or do we do what most people do, that you strike a happy medium between quantity and quality and go with what you can afford?
As far as I recall, being present at all talks during this workshop, I haven't seen a single number of surrogate recovery. That's why during the presentation. So I was wondering if it hasn't been done or hasn't been presented. So
I would say most of it probably wasn't presented, because I think that at least most of us that do good analytical chemistry, we have some type of surrogate recovery. Usually that data, though, just isn't shown.
So that indicates what would be the range for the recovery, for deployment, for cautious deployment in the, let's say, creek for a month?
Depends on the chemical. And at least if you're talking POSIS, and it's true for any sampler, there is a common standard, you know, or a generic extraction scheme that will give you good recovery for most compounds that you would sample. There are always exceptions. For example, with SPMDs, the classic example that we've been dealing with is pyrethroids. If you're doing the standard SPMD dialysis, you're going to get 20-30% recovery at most pyrethroids if you're lucky. What would be up to like 70 or 80 by doing multiple, 24-hour periods?
The pyrethroids, which are difficult to recover from SPMDs, we have gone from mean recoveries at the, we've gone from mean recoveries of about 10 or 15% with the standard dialysis regimen, and we've increased those to the range of 70 to 90% by going 3x24-hour sequential dialysis.
So what is your experience in regard to pesticides, for example?
I'm sorry, repeat?
I said, what is your experience in regard to pesticides on POSIS?
Well, pesticides on POSIS, it can range. For example, just a recent one that we've been dealing with, looking at some of the class of triazine-like pesticides, atrazine and similar compounds. For a lot of them, using the standard extraction, you're in the 90 to 100% range. For some other similar compounds, that's part of one of the EPA methods, you buy a mixture of 10 triazine-like compounds, and I don't remember which EPA method it is, but it's the standard mix you can buy from all the different companies. But you get a few of them in there that are just a little bit different, and I apologize, I don't remember what the different functionality on coming off the ring is, but there's one functional group that makes this certain ones a little different. Using the standard scheme, you're lucky to get 40% recovery. And it's class specific. You can look at the molecule, and all the ones you get the low recovery are all identical by this one functionality. So by saying what's the recovery for these pesticides, it's all over the place. That's why, we strongly encourage, if you have a set list of analytes you're targeting, take the time before. I mean, ideally you do it before you went to the field. You would at least spike your sampler regardless of SPMD, POSIS, polyethylene strip, whatever it is, and do your extraction and see what do you recover and how much will you recover. If you've already got your samplers in the field, then I would definitely do it before you did your extraction, you know, because your samplers are going to be safe in their sealed containers in the freezer. But you need to have some idea of what your recovery is if you're going to be making some big conclusions. Because you may conclude that we didn't see chemical X in this watershed. Well, if you didn't do any recovery experiments for chemical X, it very well may still be on the sampler and you just didn't get it off.
Well, every chem, at least every lab that I worked in, analytical laboratory, does on a regular basis spiking. And we have the idea and ranges for historically, for several years, what our recoveries of spikes are. So that's not a problem. My problem is recovery from the deployed sampler. That I would like to get a feeling for.
And like I say, you know, for some chemicals we can tell you. For the POSIS, it's still new. We're, you know, every few months or every new project, we're adding new chemicals. So there's a very small data set that either my center or other people in the room or around the world could provide you that data. You know, there's probably only maybe a half dozen, definitely less than 10 papers that's been published to this point, and a lot of those are all using the exact same chemicals, so there's just not a lot of data yet. Regardless if the sampler's been deployed or a freshly prepared one in the lab, hopefully that won't affect your recovery much. There may be some matrix issues depending, and not really matrix based on the sample, more background issues as far as all the other stuff that was sampled out of the environment that may affect your recovery from a field deployed sampler, but hopefully that'd be minimal. And the only way you would know that is by spiking your mixture onto a sampler, you know, sort of a standard edition type study, and look at it that way. Because there are matrix effects that have been observed.
Just a quick comment. Yeah, the standard edition method is the way to go, but I know that Dave has done some studies in which he's spiked Oasis, for example, and left it for how long?
Up to a month.
A month, just to see that nothing's going on, you know, no interactions with the Oasis adsorbent, and the recoveries have always been good. But we don't know what your analytes are, and so I would also think that as far as once you put a POSIS out in the field, since this process is lone pair interactions mainly, is the driving mechanism of adsorption, and it is adsorption and not partitioning, that it's a competitive process, just like adsorption. You can, if you put other organic chemicals that are, they're not your analytes, but there's stuff there they're competing for similar sites, then you have some desorption. You can that is an issue with POSIS and all of the adsorption type samplers. It's this competitive adsorption phenomenon. But what that does in my mind, unless there's some sort of reaction with the things that are being adsorbed, is that it increases your ability to recover your analytes. There's, because there's other stuff out there competing for the same sites. So I wouldn't think that you would see a recovery issue.
Talking about recovery, I just wondering, when we spike the standard to the solvent, do we have to wait like a half day or overnight or just 1 hour later to the extension? Second question, when we spike the like PRC or strong gauge standards to the solvent, like each sample we have to open and spike on the solvent. I mean, if we each sample have to do this, that's a lot of work. And also, is that possible the solvent lost during this procedure?
Those are all good concerns that, you know, is part of the difficulty and care that it takes working with these samplers. Your first part of the question, as far as how long do you wait after you spike? That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't seen where time really matters. And if it did matter, then that would kind of be bad for the sampler. I mean, the sampler wasn't going to work very well because the longer it was out, the more difficult it would be to recover your compound. What I generally do in our studies is I spike the chemical on the sampler. I let the solvent, I use some solvent like acetone or something that's going to evaporate quickly. I let it evaporate and then do my extraction. I have done a few where I've, quote unquote, aged it, where I let it sit for a while, but I didn't see a whole lot of difference. Generally, we don't have time to wait for, we just let the solvent dry and go. Second part, as far as if you're spiking individual samplers, if you're talking about posis, yes, you have to be careful opening every one because you got to make sure you hold them flat. That way you don't lose any absorbent. Typically, we don't spike every individual one. At least in our studies, we don't. We generally just have a separate sample that our surrogates go into, and we use it as a representative sampler for that processing set. So if you ran multiple sets, you'd have like one of these spikes for each set. But if you wanted to spike each one, then you got a couple options. Either you're very careful and you open each one up and you do it, or if you're spiking after they came back from the field, that's the only way to do it. If you're spiking before they go to the field, as for example, you're doing a PRC approach, then if you had a lot of samplers, the easy thing to do may be to spike a large batch of your sorbent, enough of which it would cover all the samplers, blend it so you get a homogeneous mixture, and then use that spike mixture to make all of your samplers, and then have some left over that you can use as your quality control to make sure that you did an adequate job of blending. We do that with SPMDs on large studies that we spike with, where you have every SPMD and you maybe have hundreds of them that are going to be spiked with the same PRC compound. We'll spike our Triolean ahead of time enough for the whole set. That way it's consistently an equal amount in each SPMD.
Yeah, for the SPMDs, yes, we spike all of them, like then take a different, all just one meal like this. But for pulses, I mean, each one, like a disc, we have to open. We do not have nature sorting, and then we mix it together and then separate two different discs.
But if you're doing it where you have just the individuals,
we can do this.
It's just work. It's one of these things. If you want that type of information, you're going to have to care and the time to open it up and spike them. I don't know that there's an easier way to do it. If there is, I hope somebody tells me.
Yeah, that's possible. We just buy the sorting, then we can do spike and separate two different.
Wherever you get your samplers from, work with.
I think we bought from.
If you're going through EST,
Terry, you
talk to Terry about what you can do with the company, and that's between you and the company. Otherwise, you're going to be opening them up and spiking them all, or Terry will be opening them up, spiking them all. Having unkind thoughts with everyone. But no, the only two ways I can do it is you spike a big batch of sorbent and mix it, or you spike every one. But if this gets back to the other question earlier, as far as if you're adding surrogates to your samplers, regardless of the SPMD or POSIS or whatever, and you're putting it out in the field, what type of question are you trying to answer? If you're wanting to look at just recovery based on what was in the field, well, if you have a lower, say if we talk in SPMD here, and say you added deuterated pHs, well, your lower pHs are going to leave just like a PRC. So then how do you know is it a PRC effect or is it just a recovery effect? So in that case, the only way you're going to look at recovery from the system is if you add a high molecular weight pH that is not going to leave the SP&D during deployment. So, you know, there's multiple questions here depending on what type of information you're hoping to get out.
I have a difficult time hearing this one here, which is pointed toward you. I'm sorry. So is your question related to PRC's proposes or for spiking surrogates?
Both. I think we will spike all PRC and also songing.
Okay, well, right now we have no viable PRC's proposes. I mean, Nicholas has some promising work where he used DIA, it's metabolized atrazine. But we really don't have any PRC compounds selected because we really don't know how to do that with an adsorbent yet. What we've done, though, is what Dave does all the time, is to put, and we're planning on doing this in the future, until we can do more research on how to pick the right PRCs for this OASIS adsorbent, is just to put a SPMD or possibly even a silicone bit in the holder, just like it was a OASIS, to get to the environmental exposure effect. In other words, it would be like, there's two factors that affect the uptake of things, and one of them, of course, is the environment, and the other thing is the chemical. There's actually three, really. The preceding phase, or the adsorbent, or the polyethylene, or the lipid, whatever. So, basically, with an adsorbent sense, you have competitive adsorption, you have a very high binding energy relative to partitioning because the molecule is immobilized, at least in a planar matter. It may move around on the surface of the adsorbent. The theory is that it's not fusing into the polymer matrix itself, or it wouldn't be a very good, your recoveries would be very bad in steep hysteresis. So, but the point here is that right now, to deal with the environmental factors, is that we're temporarily using another device that's mounted, so hopefully the hydrodynamics would be exactly the same, that is the water flow and all the other temperature, of course, would be the same. Biofouling may be somewhat different, but I don't think that that's an issue, and not from what people are seeing in particular. But the flow is a key thing, and it is very specific to where that probably the flow effects are even specific to where in the camera that your disc is.
I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt. I just have to make a very brief announcement. For those of you participating online, we were only able to broadcast up until 10 a.m. Eastern Time. So we will be ending the online broadcast. I'm really excited and happy to see this dialogue. It will continue in the room, and we will continue to record it for the archive.